Hello everyone, I'm Harry Bucknell. Thank you for downloading this special edition of General Talk, marking the death of Her Late Majesty, Queen Elizabeth II. On the 8th of September, a dark pall fell over the world when the death of our much-loved Queen, Commander-in-Chief and Patron of ABF, the Soldiers' Charity, was announced from Balmoral in Scotland. A mother, grandmother and great-grandmother, throughout the country, Commonwealth and beyond, the outpourings of grief, sadness and sorrow, a testament to the enormous love and affection with which she was held, and the respect and esteem she had earned after 7 decades as our sovereign, whose reign was founded on the unquestionable pillars of faith, duty, and service, placing crown and people before all else. To discuss momentous events over the last 12 days, I am joined by Alistair Bruce, Major General and Governor of Edinburgh Castle, Officer of Arms in the Royal Household, Fitz Alan Pursuivant as Herald, Member of the Royal Company of Archers, and the Royal Religious and National Events Commentator for Sky News. Thank you for joining this programme.
From my point of view, I know a great deal about why things are done, because that's really what interests me. And a state funeral has, basically at the heart of it, a very simple Christian funeral, which needs to be delivered for the soul of the departed. But yet what the state wishes to add to that in terms of its history and its traditions makes it that much more of an event. And, you know, we have this palette of colour that the nation can apply to almost any great moment. And we've watched that already with the late Queen being conveyed from Buckingham Palace to Westminster Hall, but also up in Scotland, you know, the amazing Operation Unicorn that we witnessed, which, you know, and I speak as somebody working with the army in Scotland now as the Governor of Edinburgh Castle, I am profoundly proud of the way in which the Royal Regiment of Scotland and the Royal Company of Archers stepped up to and delivered for the Queen.
It is perhaps useful to the cause of Scottish unity that Her Majesty the Queen managed to die in Scotland.
I think the Queen's departure in Scotland really mattered from the point of view that she was at home. She was surrounded in the months previous by her family, and that fate would have it, she had her eldest son and daughter with her when she died. And what could be better? You see, Scotland has always throughout history raised itself to a challenge. The fact that she was the first monarch to die in Scotland since James V in 1542 is perhaps beside the point. But at the same time, Scots know how to directly respond to in a moment, and I think they did it really beautifully.
And we, of course, are talking at the moment before the funeral takes place of Her Majesty on Monday. You worked closely with the Queen over a number of projects, from the coronation in 2017, for BBC television, for Days of Majesty, Keepers of the Kingdom, and of course you had that splendid image of Chief of Chiefs by Julian Calder, which you included in your book, Keepers of the Kingdom, for 1993. What is your reminiscences of being in the Queen's company and her presence? What was she like as a character to work with?
Well, first of all, you say I work closely with her. I think the Queen would rather view it as I was something of a mosquito, I think. But I think she recognised I cared about the office that she served. And as I think her whole raison d'etre was to be a human being living a life that supported exactly the same thing, that office, I think she was more content to go along with some of the ideas that I proposed. I was not trying to film her being her. I was not trying to find out anything about how she lived her life or the manner in which she operated. I was interested in the office. And certainly, when we were talking about the coronation in 1953, she was fascinating to the extent that I laid before her quite a lot of the footage of the coronation. And I said to her in passing, "I imagine you've seen this many times before." And she said, "No, I've never seen it." And I was somewhat nonplussed. And then there was a pause and she filled it with, "Why would I?" And I think the reason that it surprises me is revealed in what she then went on to say. She said, "It's different for you, Alistair. You've studied it all your life. I lived it. I had to get it right. And it's done."
In that sense, she is, or the monarchy is an instrument of constitution. In 1998, you were appointed herald by the Queen, and indeed you are now the FitzAlan Pursuivant Herald. We've seen during this period not only the death of the monarch, we've also seen the seamless and peaceable transfer of authority from one head of state to another, taking place almost unnoticed, in fact, without incident.
Well, it's designed by the Constitution and by statute law to be automatic. So the moment the Queen died, we had a new king. That was proverbially the heartbeat. But then we have a series of really quite tedious procedural processes that the Constitution takes its way through. And the first of those is the Accession Council. And for the first time, the King gave permission for that to be witnessed by cameras. And I think two things were revealed. One, how dull it is. And secondly, yet how deeply moving it is to watch a moment where the taking on is done by the new sovereign and the recognition that the taking on has happened. And from the point of view of the way the King did it, with, I think, eminent grace and calm, with his wife and son beside him, it was really moving to see in one room really gathered the great faces of the last 30 years and to know that they are affirming this new beginning and that the King is, as it were, dedicating himself to do that. And also, I think people were mesmerized that the Constitution requires only one promise by the monarch in order to become sovereign, and that is to support the independence of the Church of Scotland and its constitution. And I think it's delicious as a Scot that everyone in the United Kingdom is reminded that no one can become sovereign until they've done that.
Whereas it has pleased Almighty God to call to his mercy our late Sovereign Lady, Queen Elizabeth II, of blessed and glorious memory, by whose decease the crown of the United Kingdom of Great Britain and Northern Ireland is solely and rightfully come to the Prince Charles Philip Arthur George. We, therefore, the Lords spiritual and temporal of this realm, and members of the House of Commons, together with other members of Her Late Majesty's Privy Council, and representatives of the realms and territories, aldermen and citizens of London and others, do now hereby, with one voice and consent of tongue and heart, publish and proclaim that the Prince Charles Philip Arthur George is now, by the death of our late sovereign of happy memory, become our only lawful and rightful liege lord, Charles III. By the grace of God, of the United Kingdom of Great Britain and Northern Ireland, and of his other realms and territories, King, head of the Commonwealth, defender of the faith, to whom we do acknowledge all faith and obedience with humble affection, beseeching God, by whom kings and queens do reign, to bless His Majesty with long and happy years to reign over us. Given at St. James's Palace this 10th day of September, in the year of our Lord, 2022.
His Majesty King Charles III, proclaimed monarch by Garter King of Arms from the balcony of Friary Court in St. James's Palace, following the meeting of the Accession Council on Saturday, the 10th of September.
By the time this programme goes out, we will have completed the funeral of Her Majesty the Queen. British royal funerals historically were ill-planned, often shambolic affairs, oscillating between farce and fiasco, and to quote David Carradine in The Invention of Tradition. Charles Greville called George IV's funeral in 1830 a wretched mockery. William IV left early. The Times said of the mourners, it had never been so motley, so rude, so ill-managed a body of persons. But the funeral, this funeral coming up, is going to be a major world event. Can you outline some of the organisation behind it and what it will involve?
Well, first, if I may, I will just address what you have summarised. And I know David Cannadine's work very well, inevitably. The fact is that there were no cameras. There was no audience of import apart from the aristocracy who took part in these events. And they didn't care much. And the army of the day wasn't particularly well run, pre-Cardwell's army reforms. And I'm not surprised it was all chaos. But the bottom line is, at the heart of it, there was the commendation of a Christian soul to God, which of course is all that matters. But since Queen Victoria's funeral in the early part of 1901, when they had arrived with the train so late at Windsor that the gun carriage and the horses ready to pull it, the horses had got so, well, basically they'd frozen solid pretty much, and they kicked the traces. And basically there was this embarrassing moment with the king watching, everyone around him, the Emperor of Germany, and this gun carriage wasn't going to move. So when Louis of Battenberg stepped forward and said, why don't I get the sailors lining the street to get the ropes that are holding the people back, tie it to the gun carriage and pull, I think Edward VII was delighted. But now we have this excellence at the heart of what we deliver. I think it was the Chief of the Defence Staff, Sir Nick Carter, who said, look, you know, as an army, the British Army does things excellently, as do many other armies. But what we do excellently in a way that nobody else in the world does is what we will witness on Monday when the Queen is laid to rest. Our ceremonial is phenomenal. It tells a story, it has a narrative, and at its heart is the passion of the history of our armed forces writ large and laid at the feet of the late sovereign. It's perfect.
It is a combined national effort. Police, NHS, soldiers, sailors, airmen, the whole kit and caboodle, everybody.
But in the middle of it, you've got to have a guardsman who's got immaculate boots, knows what to do, is competent enough to do it, and does it with style.
The Queen has served the nation magnificently. I'd like to talk about the legacy of her unique reign, which lasted over seven decades, and the likes of which we shall never see again. What do you think is her contribution to the national identity of today?
I'm very nervous over this line, we will never see it again. I think if you look at more recent monarchs, you have a collection of people who dedicated themselves and delivered excellence. I think George V, to me as a constitutionalist, was probably the great architect of constitutional government with the greatest ability demonstrated by knowing and being honest about where his abilities were limited. And, you know, that's a great deal of wisdom. Then George VI, who was written in one of the great biographies, the biographer summarised, if a king can be judged to have been successful or not on the basis of how he or she rises to the challenge of their time, then George VI was a very great king. Now, Elizabeth II has been a marvellous and excellent queen, but I have no hesitation to think that we are going to be surprised again and again. Yes, it was a long reign, but I think there's every hope. You see, if you go back to 1714, the nation wasn't really much looking forward to George I arriving from Hanover. And George II equally couldn't speak German. And if you go through every single monarch, almost all of them, prior to ascending the throne, including the late Queen, had been viewed by the British public with some trepidation, except the man who became Edward VIII. And I think the fact that if there is any hesitation out there as to quite what a new king we might have, I hope that's blasted out of the water, because I think he will prove us to be unbelievably adroit in the terms of the Constitution. He's a terribly passionate man. And when that is taken away from what he's been doing as heir apparent and brought into the delivery of leadership as the head of state, I think it's going to surprise us all. I think it's going to be absolutely excellent. I've completely forgotten what question you asked me now.
Doesn't matter. It's a very good answer anyway. Also, I'd like to talk about the values and principles that her late Majesty stood for. What do you consider that were her sort of the hallmarks of her reign?
Well, I don't think they're the values she stood for, because I don't think in that sense that was the nature of her. I think what she quietly did was to present a clarity of identity in her dedication as somebody who had gone through the monastic doors to fulfill the office that she inherited from her father, aged 25. And by that, she set herself at naught. And not many people can do that in modern Britain. In fact, I've watched people experience her obsequies so far, not just by witnessing the moving moment of the hearse or the gun carriage going past, but this need by everybody to film it so that they have their personal experience of that moment. You see, the Queen didn't do things ever for herself. Now, that may be standing for something, but standing for something is more, I think, what a sort of determined politician might do. I think the Queen represented much, and it was courtesy, continuance, service, and a degree of deep dignity of conviction. But I don't think she ever expected anybody else to necessarily do it the same. But when we try and encompass what her life was about and call it duty, I think that's really what we're wrapping up into a great big sausage roll.
What do you think the challenges are that which face King Charles III and the now reorganised or reorganising royal family?
That's a matter for him. But what I think in the wider sense is that the United Kingdom itself faces economic challenges. We, as the armed forces, will face whatever challenges are required to defend his kingdom. And just as had happened quite soon before the Queen came to the throne, there is war in Europe. I think those are the challenges that will really matter. And I'm convinced that the King will find a way to respond as head of state, using his family in an appropriate manner to all of that.
In the Queen's heyday, the royal family performed up to 3,000 official events, engagements in a year. With a smaller, reduced family of up to six working individuals, it might come down to 1,000. So we'll see the royal family less visible, perhaps, in society, do you think?
I've no idea. But whatever happens, I think the King will make sure that as head of state, he leads in the way that makes most sense on the advice of His Majesty's government. And where members of his family who are wishing to do it choose to support him and he wants them to do it, I'm sure it'll work very well. It always has. When the Queen came to the throne, she had very little help from her family because, I mean, she had a sister who was still quite young. Her mother withdrew from public life for really quite a long time until Churchill persuaded her to step back in. There was the Duke of Gloucester, but the Duke of Kent had died. And her other uncle, the Duke of Windsor, was really beyond using. So that's why so many of the Queen's cousins were asked to help her with the burden. And we've sort of taken them for granted, really. But they too were asked to go through the monastic door. And almost all of them find that doable. But it's quite a challenge, you know.
We go on from here to build up to the coronation, a time of great celebration. What is the significance of this great event?
Well, the significance of it is that it was first performed in England according to Frankish and Byzantine custom in the year 973 by St. Dunstan when he crowned Edgar the Peaceable. So that's pretty interesting. We are now the last nation in Europe that has a coronation, really in the world. And yet it's arguably completely unnecessary. But there is a moment that I think is important in the five principal parts of the ceremony, and that is the sovereign's oath. And Parliament will have to address this. What do they require the new king to make his oath towards? There aren't many nations that have heads of state who come to office without making them make an oath. And in essence, we have a head of state. I know he has limited power, and we live in a parliamentary constitutional monarchy. But at the same time, we should be aware that having an oathed monarch is a sensible idea. So I think that remains the key of it. But visually, the moment of coronation will be something that can play again and again and again. And there is something very magical that, again, we can reach into the box of time and bring out every element of the nation. And perhaps with new elements of faith that have emerged during the late Queen's reign to be celebrated at the coronation of the kings. And we will be told in due course what date it is. I don't think it'll be as far away as, how shall I put it, the ridiculously long wait of 18 months between the accession of the last queen and her coronation. But that was really a political trick played by Churchill. And, you know, I admire him for it. But no, I think this probably won't be too long a wait, but it will be very splendid. It'll also be very faithful. And some people will find that difficult because we are a post-faith and a post-deferential society, apparently.
At the moment.
And so let's see.
It's a great celebration. Do you think it'll be as momentous in the same way as the 1953 coronation?
Harry, it's very difficult to know quite what will happen. I have learned as a journalist that you wait and see what does happen and then reflect on it. What the nation decides to do with the opportunity, however, is up to the leadership of the government of the day to make it so. And I think the United Kingdom would be mad, despite the fact they'll be facing challenges, because you can adjust the ceremony to whatever you require, to miss this opportunity to convey and communicate to the world. You see, we're all busy watching the Queen's death and funeral and the processes in between from a very domestic point of view, but the world is watching. And apparently even Putin has watched. And they are making judgments about us that are not necessarily, although they may use the words, at our stuffy interest in the past, but they're seeing how perhaps reassured we are to walk with our past. And I think the nation has an opportunity to take all that it has in its rich treasure trove and turn it into a springboard for something. But that leadership will have to come from government, and also with the support and with perhaps a bit of tweaking direction from the new king.
Governor of Edinburgh Castle, you're the only serving veteran of the Falklands War, one of the army's longest serving soldiers. You know the royal family inside out and the Queen intimately. When you look back on that most special of relationships with Her Majesty, what is your fondest memory of our Sovereign Lady?
I think that I look back on my service with immense pride. I have always loved being in the army. I find soldiers the most inspiring and hilarious, courageous, stupid, and at the end, really affirming people that I've shared my life with. And I wouldn't be without any one of them. And the privilege of being called by the army and have my name put forward to the Queen to be Governor of Edinburgh Castle for a Scot and for a Bruce could not have been more of a privilege. It has been really special to serve. In fact, I came back from the Canongate Kirk after divine service the other day to the castle. I parked my car and big groups of tourists come around the castle, and there was a guide with his back to me, but all his tourists were looking straight at me, and he shouted out, "The governor these days is very old and at the end of his military career." And I shouted from my car, "I'm not old and I'm not at the end of my career." So certainly my view is that I will finally stand down after the tattoo in 2024. And I joined the army in 1979. And I am very lucky to have served that long. I am already the oldest general. And when General Sinnott Carter left, I took on that battle. But I am very used to being a reservist, responding to and answering to the commands of people who are much younger than me. And actually, it's frightfully good for you. And I'm enjoying it very much. I just had lunch with my mother, and she said that this was her fifth reign, and that she was nine when she went to the King's funeral, King George V. And I think, you know, that is quite interesting. We're just moving you and I into our second reign.
Yeah.
And time and the privilege of serving a sovereign who's lasted for so long. You know, I'm really lucky to have served as a soldier during her reign, but my goodness, I look forward to serving the King.
I bet. Can I ask you to answer the question? What's your favourite reminiscence of working with the Queen? It was a lovely answer, by the way, but I'll just throw at it.
I suppose I've had many occasions when I've had the privilege of doing things with her. I'll remember a few of them. When we photographed her with the Imperial State Crown, and it arrived in a box and I had to get it out because the Lord Chamberlain's office said they weren't allowed to touch it. But here were a pair of gloves. And the fun of getting it out of its box and holding this incredible symbol of our nation with the Black Prince's ruby, the sapphire that was taken from Edward the Confessor's ring finger when Henry III translated his body in the 1200s from one part of Westminster Abbey to another. So, you know, that moment. The interactions with her as a person have always been very precious. But I remember when we took a photograph of her dressed in the robes of the most ancient and most noble Order of the Thistle, which has a star that was actually the cap star of my regiment, the Scots Guards, with its wonderful motto, Nemo me impune lacessit. And I persuaded the Queen to put her robes on to be photographed. She thought in the garden of Balmoral, but I said no and showed her on a laptop that I was holding a picture of me standing on a husk of heather out in the moorland at the Gelder. And she looked from my laptop to the window in her sitting room where sideways stair rod rain was passing by, and then silently again back to my eyes. And I said, it's going to stop raining this afternoon. She said, well, I'll make my decision then. So she came back from lunch at her log cabin, put on the robe, she still had her walking shoes on, and she picked up the Vladimir tiara and just stuffed it on her head. And I thought we'd have plenty of time to get out there ahead of her and set up. There was a photographer, Julian Calder, me, and an assistant, but not a bit of it. She was ready downstairs, getting into her Range Rover, and I tore ahead with Julian in our Discovery. And we drove, it's about 25 minutes out to the Gelder cottage. And I thought she was going to dress out there. I was just so surprised. She already had the tiara on. And when we got there, we rushed around. But the Queen got closer and closer. So the faster we drove, the closer her car came. I don't know how. Anyway, we met this family on the way who were out having a walk, because in Scotland, you can walk anywhere. And they had to get out of the track, you know, these sort of two lines where the wheels go straight through the middle of absolutely nowhere. And we were quite surprised to find them. Anyway, they got out and they stared in to the window to see, I'm afraid, little old me at the front, of no consequence at all, unless they watch a lot of Sky News. And then we drove on, and of course the Queen came through behind, wearing the beautiful, rich, bottle green velvet robes of the Order of the Thistle, a tiara with the Cambridge emeralds glittering, her incredible Cambridge earrings as well, the actual earrings, you know, sparkling away. And when we got to the Gelder, I jumped out of my car and told Julian, just get everything ready as quickly as you can. And I went to open the Queen's door, and I opened the door, and she referred to the family who got out of the way and said, they must think I'm mad. And I said to her, well, I think they think you dress like this for dinner every day. And just seeing her get out, and there are plenty of pictures of it, as she is walking across the moorland in these robes. And I think she always wondered, you know, what would her father think? Because I think Elizabeth II always worried whether she was ruling in accordance with what would have made her father proud. And I drew attention to this as I was commentating the Globemaster taxiing to take off on that really peaceful evening in Edinburgh. And I told a story about her concern for her father and how that must have influenced her. And as that aircraft took off, I said, I am certain King George VI was very proud of her.
Major General Alastair Bruce, Governor of Edinburgh Castle, thank you for being my guest on General Talk today.
With editing by Steve Campen at Creative Radio, this has been a Gamekeeper production for ABF, the Soldiers Charity.